When I first saw him, he looked wildly out of context. This was a place of ice and tundra, of weathered brown skin and tan Carhartts. But this guy showed up in neon-colored rain gear with hippie jewelry and zero explanation of what he was doing there. And he couldn't really tell us because he only spoke Japanese. I was an outsider too. A reporter based in Anchorage, Alaska, I had traveled hundreds of miles to this remote community up against the Arctic Circle. The village is made up almost entirely of Inupiaq Eskimo people who have lived there for countless generations. I was staying in a double-wide trailer, which was the only lodging available in Shishmaref. And on a gray October afternoon, this brightly colored visitor showed up. A local guy had walked him over from the airstrip and was eager to hand him off. "What's he doing here?" I asked. The local guy shrugged, indicating the new guy would be staying in the trailer, and took off. Takesh was friendly enough. "I am carpenter," he explained with the help of his phrasebook. "Summer, I am bartender." Now, it's hard to overstate how unlikely it is that you just wind up in a place like Shishmaref. There are no roads to the rest of the world. Just to get here from Anchorage, you have to take 3 airplanes. There are 2 general stores, a small leather tannery, and not much else. And there's no plumbing in most of the village. Instead, people poop in what they call honey buckets. Over the course of the afternoon, Takesh and I managed to reconstruct the basics. He was from Tokyo, and he was traveling through Alaska, retracing the steps of a famous Japanese photographer decades before. Takesh had a pretty nice camera himself. After a little while, he went off to go explore the village to take pictures of ramshackle houses, racks of drying fish, and curing seal meat. The main people who visit Shishmaref tend to be reporters, like me, and scientists, both groups drawn by the fact that Shishmaref is on the front lines of climate change. Increased flooding and coastal erosion are eating away at this ancient community, and the people were being forced to consider picking up their village and putting it down somewhere safe. There was one other category of regular visitors, and that was contractors. During my stay, I shared living quarters with 2 of these guys, laborers named Guy and Dick. They were in from Nome, and they were of stereotypical Alaskan old white guy stock. Guy was tall and chatty, with a thick horseshoe mustache. Dick was white-haired and wiry, and wore flannel shirts and mesh ball caps. In the evening, they'd mix cocktails, secretly, it's a dry village, and tell stories of itinerant work around rural Alaska. By late afternoon, they rolled in from a day of work at the tannery, and I informed them about our new roommate. Guy's eyebrows went up, he glanced at Dick, shrugged his shoulders, and headed into his room. But Dick, on the other hand, scowled.
"Japanese," he grumbled. "They're trained to hate us, you know. I like everybody, but I hate the Japanese."
Now, I grew up in the 80s in Ohio and had been exposed to a wide variety of bigotry, and this was 2004 when post-9/11 tensions were still sizzling. Still, wasn't prejudice against Japan a little out of date? But Dick had grown up in a different era, less World Trade Center, more Pearl Harbor.
"I won't stay here with him, I mean it, I'll go sleep in the f***ing tannery."
Dick retreated into his little bedroom, and I did the thing I do when I'm caught off guard by racism. I had a vigorous argument with myself over how much to challenge it. Dick's opinions were baked in 1941, so didn't seem likely that I could talk him out of them. But Takesh was also coming back in a few hours, so I decided that if Dick gave him a hard time, at least I'd push back. As I waited, I couldn't help but think about the generation of Americans defined not by World War II, but by 9/11, and I wondered whether 60 years from now, people my age would be refusing to share a roof with visitors from Muslim countries. Meanwhile, I waited for this very strange racial clash between a white guy and a Japanese guy set in a double-wide trailer on the edge of the continent. By the time Takesh returned, my head was spinning. A younger local guy named Dennis was with him and had seemingly adopted Takesh as his charge. This may have changed Dick's calculations because when he opened up his door, he didn't unload on Takesh, who now had local reinforcements. Or maybe Dick just understood what I'd already concluded. that airing generations-old racial grievances in a remote Inupiaq Eskimo village was kind of ridiculous. Anyway, Dick collected his day bag and skulked out of the trailer, and I don't think he spent another night there. Meanwhile, Takesh was attempting to teach Dennis how to fold an origami paper crane, and I joined in. We were pretty bad at it, and soon we were laughing and communicating in exaggerated hand gestures and broken Japanese. Dennis gave him a pair of reindeer hide slippers, and I showed him how my radio gear worked. It became easy, much less labored than trying to hold a conversation with Dick and Guy over illicit cocktails. Days later, a major storm slammed into Shishmaref. The ocean took huge bites out of the dwindling coastline. This was the changing climate having its way with a small, vulnerable village. Dennis and I zoomed around on his four-wheeler while the storm raged so I could do my reporting. And at one point, Dennis spotted something in the surf and grabbed it. It was a little green glass globe, a fishing net float with a Japanese character on it. This ball had drifted all the way across the Pacific Ocean, up through the Bering Straits, and come to rest unannounced on this faraway shore. Kind of like someone else I know. Later, we took the glass ball back to the trailer and asked Takesh to translate the character. Takesh scrunched up his eyebrows. He flipped through one paperback dictionary, then another. Finally, he shut the book and, beaming, delivered a translation that also described the world I was living in. Small.